On November 22, 1963, Robert Kennedy received a phone call that altered his life forever. The president, his brother, had been shot. JFK would not survive. In the revolution of Robert Kennedy from power to protest after JFK, journalist John Borer focuses on Bobby Kennedy's life during the 3 years following JFK's assassination, culminating with RFK's Ripple of Hope speech in Cape Town, South Africa. Torn between mourning the past and plotting his future, Kennedy was placed in a sudden competition with his political enemy, Lyndon Johnson, for control of the Democratic Party. John Borer is a reporter, historian, and television news producer currently working for MSNBC and is the author of the new book, The Revolution of Robert Kennedy, From Power to Protest After JFK. And we welcome John Borer to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure being here. Thank you.
What brought you to look at RFK and specifically his life after the death of his brother?
Yeah, I wanted to understand why Robert Kennedy appealed to so many people across political boundaries, people who are conservative, people who are liberal. They all seem to consider him a political hero. And I think that's because Robert Kennedy understood change and was able to make people less afraid of change. And I think that's something he learned in those years after his brother's death, when his life really became about upheaval. He is the insider, the attorney general, his brother's closest advisor, suddenly cast out. His political enemy is the president of the United States, Lyndon Johnson. And he has to grapple with an unknown political terrain. And most of these books about Robert Kennedy sort of take you into his depression. And then he runs for the Senate, rebels on Vietnam, and then runs for president himself, when it was actually a lot more complicated if you look at it as a day-by-day political journey as we would a modern kind of candidate or figure. So I wanted to restore that. I went back in the memoranda into the news clips. He was so extremely covered in this time, probably second only to President Johnson. And it reveals a much more complicated path, one which wasn't so certain, and some of the things in it look almost insane in hindsight of what he decided would be the best path forward.
In talking about that uncertainty, his struggle, and a real struggle to find his place within the Johnson administration.
Yeah, think of it this way. Robert Kennedy thought that the Kennedy family was not going to mean much in a few months. He tells people in December of 1963, get what you want now because we won't matter in 11 months on Election Day 1964. It was going to be Lyndon Johnson's party. And therefore, Bobby decides that the most conventional way for him to remain in public service and to keep doing what his brother would have wanted him to was to seek the vice presidency under Lyndon Johnson. And this has been reported somewhat in the past, but is more of a passing fascination for Bobby, when really he was a very active player in some of the things I uncovered about his contacts with people in New Hampshire when it was a write-in primary in 1964 for the vice presidency as well as the other office. He was waging this sort of campaign going to these different cities outlined by a strategist of his to meet with power brokers and to start winning over converts, people who thought he was ruthless before, to trust him, to take the Democratic convention in Atlantic City in 1964. And Lyndon Johnson knew what Bobby was up to. And one of the interesting things I uncovered was he weighed firing him on the eve of the New Hampshire primary, asking him to resign his office as attorney general because of his political activity. And it really came to a head, and they really battled it out there.
One wonders in reading the book, as he was secretly campaigning to be the next vice president, of how you do that, secretly campaigning
right.
to be the vice president.
Absolutely. You have to kind of put it in a modern context. This is before the 25th Amendment. When the vice presidency was vacated, it would be vacant for all that time. I mean, for Harry Truman didn't have a vice president for all those years after he inherited the office from Franklin Roosevelt. At the time, too, the primary system wasn't as powerful as it was, so it was power brokers and the people who went to the Democratic convention. One of the people I talk about, Bobby had a meeting with, And then the person soon after endorsed him for vice president was the boss of Buffalo. And at the time, Buffalo was the 15th largest metropolitan area in the United States. And it was a major contributor to the New York State delegation, the largest delegation at the Democratic Convention. These were the kind of people Bobby needed to persuade in order to win this office. And so it was definitely a different kind of dynamic. Ultimately, though, Lyndon Johnson held the cards that he needed to win.
Through this time and through working very hard and looking to strategists and various people for help and advice, he eventually found a voice. He found a very distinct, independent voice. Talk a little bit about that.
One of the things Robert Kennedy realized about Lyndon Johnson was that he didn't understand political loyalty. And Johnson displays this to Bobby when he badmouths his own staff to him. And Bobby says, if he can't be loyal to these people who serve him, how could he be loyal to me? How could I work with him? I just can't. So Bobby is then, he decides to run for the Senate in New York State in 1964. There's a liberal Republican running for the office, but the Johnson landslide sweeps him in. He goes to the Senate, and he starts to realize that he can make a difference by speaking out, and he finds his voice that way. And one of the things he begins to understand in a life that has changed so much is just how fast things are changing. And he gives the example in these speeches he delivers at Buffalo State, at Plattsburgh, and at Queens College, June of 1965, in which he talks about the speed of travel and how thousands of years of human history, it had gone from walking to riding a horse. And then within the 20th century, they had gone from Kitty Hawk, the power of flight, to two men orbiting the Earth in Gemini 4. And he said this kind of change is infecting the whole world for economic freedom, for political independence, for human dignity. And it was directed against us, the comfortable, as Bobby had been before his brother was assassinated. And he ultimately says that the tiniest thing you do can change the world. And that's where you come to the 1966 Day of Affirmation address, where he talks about each time a man stands up for an ideal or strikes out against injustice, he sends forth a tiny ripple of hope, and crossing each other from 1,000 different points of energy could build a current to sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance. And that was his message, was you can do something, you can be a part of something, you just have to try.
And that Ripple of Hope speech really was the pinnacle of a two-year evolution, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it's also one of the profound things was during Bobby's time in the Senate, Murray Kempton, the columnist, wrote that he was a name who lonely men reach for in their loneliness. And Bobby really represented a person who could influence the rest of the world. And these students from the National Union of South African Students, they reached out to Bobby because they were having trouble getting support in their own country, fighting the apartheid government, the racist regime there, in which they reached out to Martin Luther King, and the government said, no, you can't come because he's a communist and he's a rabble-rouser. And so they decided, we'll invite the highest law enforcement official in the United States, the former president's brother. And Bobby agreed to go and to lend them his support. The government, you know, the apartheid government was an ally of the United States because they were a bulwark against communism, as we considered them. And so, therefore, we were not trying to step on any toes. They didn't want to step on toes. They delayed Bobby's speech, and it ended up being on June 6, 1966. And that just so happened to be 2 years to the day before Bobby succumbed to his wounds at the Ambassador Hotel in California. And that speech that he gave about the Ripple of Hope, that is written near his gravesite, and it really became his own epitaph, his understanding of politics and change.
There's also very much a struggle about the loyalty to the country and a loyalty to the Democratic Party, and I assume that is a regular struggle of any politician, but it seems especially acute in his case.
Well, Bobby had a loyalty to Lyndon Johnson as his brother's vice president and also a loyalty to his brother's cabinet. But as things progressed in Vietnam, Bobby found that he could no longer stay silent. He had been advising LBJ early on in May of 1964, talking about the situation, saying, We have a political problem here, not a military one, that we're never going to solve if we don't get the government right in South Vietnam. Bobby even volunteered as a sign of loyalty to LBJ to serve as his ambassador in June of 1964. And so as time went on and the conflict grew deeper and wider and the president committed more troops, Bobby became more impatient with speaking out. And finally, in 1966, in February of 1966, Dean Rusk, the Secretary of State, speaks out at the Fulbright hearings in a kind of off-the-cuff answer about elections, saying, have elections, sure. Bobby uses that as his opportunity to spring into action to say we should invite the National Liberation Front, the political arm of the Viet Cong, into the government of South Vietnam, with give them a share of the power and responsibility of ruling that country. And he faces tremendous backlash for not only from his own party, from his brother's cabinet, but from the media as well. He realized that speaking out had to be measured against what you could accomplish, but also you couldn't subdue your morals completely for your party loyalty. And I think that's an important lesson today.
Another lesson today that I thought was interesting in the book is because we think of it now as that we are in a time of a very cynical media, but you use that term in describing the media that he faced as well.
Yes, I mean, one of the things I accomplish, I think, in this book is to look at Bobby Kennedy as a modern politician, not through the haze of 1968, in which, you know, he had been assassinated and a political martyr to and someone who's only revered. You have to look at politicians as they were judged in their time, I believe, in order to truly understand who they were and how they became who they were. And Robert Kennedy was judged very harshly, even in 1965. On Inauguration Day, he and his brother Ted begin the day by going to Arlington Cemetery to see their brother's grave and to pray for a moment. They go to the inaugural. They return home. Bobby, on his return home, passes Arlington, decides to go back and pray once again. This time, though, there had been a photographer there and a reporter there to write about his appearance. And a Republican senator made a comment anonymously to a journalist saying, "We're a pretty hard-boiled crowd. We notice stuff like that," suggesting that Bobby only went to the grave for a photo op, which was a complete misunderstanding of Bobby, but also a believable piece of anecdote that could be spun out there at the time because of, you know, the ruthlessness that he allegedly participated in. And Bobby Kennedy was a person who believed in winning elections. Sometimes he did put, you know, votes over principle, but he also had a moral core that guided him as well. And so therefore you take the good with the bad, and you have to understand how Robert Kennedy was as a human.
You mentioned Teddy Kennedy, his brother, obviously great political ambition there as well. Talk a little bit about the relationship between the two Kennedy brothers during this 2-3 year time span.
It was interesting because at first, after Bobby had been eliminated from the vice presidential race, some people considered Ted Kennedy to be the natural heir of the Kennedy dynasty and maybe the one more likely to ascend to the presidency, as Robert Healey wrote in the Boston Globe at the time. Ted Kennedy had been in the Senate before Bobby got there. He was much more at ease there. He was a comfortable person with the chairman. He could drink the bourbon with them. And Bobby was a little bit more reticent. He had trouble referring to the senators by their first name, having been attorney general for all those years. And Teddy really brought him into the club. Bobby followed his brother around in the way that Teddy had followed his older brother around when he was on the Harvard football team and Teddy was at Milford. But really, you see this closeness between the two brothers. They sort of divided up political responsibilities in the Senate. But Teddy took his, you know, responsibilities as a freshman senator much more seriously. Bobby spoke out on the Senate floor after 4 weeks of arriving, which was unheard of at the time. Teddy waited a year and a half. Bobby spent so little time presiding from the rostrum, as freshman senators do, that his secretary wrote notes to him, chiding him for, you know, really being 50 hours under where other freshman senators like Walter Mondale were at the time. So you see this kind of dynamic between the two brothers. One is on the fast track. One is slowly plodding his way through, and that would be Teddy becoming the legislator that he would later become.
When it comes to comparing that political environment to a current political environment, you make the case several times in the book of how close and how things really haven't changed, but obviously it seems a lot different, doesn't it?
It does seem a lot different, but then again, you have to look back at how these people were covered in their time. I use the example of Lyndon Johnson. When people see President Trump shoving the leader of Montenegro or, you know, shaking someone's hand like they're going to rip his arm off, I think of the Johnson treatment of Lyndon Johnson bending over T.F. Green, the senator from Rhode Island, over the desk. And I think of also the boorishness, the sort of what's considered unpresidential behavior. Well, at the time, Lyndon Johnson was lifting his dogs by their ears and lifting his shirt to show his gallbladder scar to reporters who were kind of aghast at the idea. Following these incredibly graceful and incredibly cool presidents like JFK and Barack Obama. But you also get the sort of political paranoia that you would see from Lyndon Johnson, who was engaging in conspiracy theories privately about, you know, riots in Harlem, saying that it was a Texas oil millionaire trying to steal the election from me in 1964. You see the kind of the use of the FBI as a politically loyal detective agency, in the words of Taylor Branch, in those early years of Johnson's presidency, the same sort of relationship, it seemed, that the President Trump was trying to establish with his FBI director and his Justice Department. So as we, you know, go into these uncertain times, and I, not to compare Lyndon Johnson to Donald Trump completely, considering that Lyndon Johnson had a very rigorous legislative agenda to enact and to pursue, whereas it's less clear about that with President Trump. But you understand how closely these kinds of people mirror each other, even when it seems so unprecedented.
The name of the book is The Revolution of Robert Kennedy, From Power to Protest After JFK. The book is published by Bloomsbury. John Borer, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing with us this morning.
Thank you, Joe. I appreciate it.
John Borer is the author of the new book, The Revolution of Robert Kennedy, From Power to Protest After JFK. The book is published by Bloomsbury. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.